Welcome to In the Studio. I'm Redbeard here at the world-famous Capitol Studios in Hollywood. And joining me is a guy that I've known for, gosh, I won't say how long. It's been a while, hasn't it? Welcome, and thanks for being a part of this.
Oh, it's good to be here.
Slash is with us in the studio. With an American mother that was a costume designer and an English father who did artwork for record albums, I mean, what was it like growing up in the Hudson household as far as creativity?
It was very, you know, creative. Definitely, it was also the times as well. You know, so we're talking latter part of the 60s and the early 70s. And there was definitely a creative explosion, as we all know, going on at the time. And so everybody was an artist, you know. And we were, you know, as far as my family was concerned, and all the people that they worked with, all very inspired, creative people. So it was a cool time. It was a lot of freedom, you know, to sort of just do whatever. Everybody was sort of just going with the flow of their own sort of creative wants and needs, you know. And nobody was adhering to what you would consider the establishment at that point. So it was definitely, looking back on it, it was definitely a fun period.
Wow. Did your parents encourage you in any particular creative endeavor, or did they let you find your own?
Well, I mean, I came out of the, you know, out of the box. I was into illustrating.
And, you were, really?
Yeah, so I started out as somebody that was never into painting, but I was always into anything I could do with a pencil or a pen. And I was, you know, I still do it to this, you know, I still just sort of design album covers and stuff for myself.
Really?
And for the bands that I've been in, there's a sort of touch of my sort of talents in there. Yeah. But it, as a kid, that's all I did. And I was very much into that. And was completely focused on art. And then at some point, I switched over to guitar.
Yeah, we'll talk about that. That's right. Now, I really don't know, and I'm dying, I'd love to share it with our audience. What album covers would your father, would we know that we would have in our album collections today that your father designed? But did he do the artwork or the graphic design or all?
He did a lot of Joni Mitchell album covers.
Oh,
he did all of the Joni Mitchell album covers up until, I don't know, Miles of Isles or somewhere around there. So everything.
Sure.
So that was all her paintings and his album jacket design.
So the Hissing of Summer Lawns.
For the Roses, all those records.
Oh, I have all of those, of course.
Neil Young and Crazy Horse, and there were some artists who were big then that aren't around now, like Tom Blue was one of them.
Mm-hmm. That's cool.
And there were some other ones, but all Geffen artists, because my dad used to do primarily work for Geffen.
Wow.
So it was interesting when I later ended up at Geffen Records.
Yeah.
That's a whole other story.
Okay.
But so he did a lot of that stuff, but my dad, you know, he's a graphic designer, so he did all kinds of stuff, plus he was a photographer.
Fine.
Still is, sort of. Is definitely still an artist, but he got a job as an album cover designer. So my dad's pretty much a free spirit, you know. His one lesson to me was all you need is a piece of paper and a pencil, you know. So I've never been a very material person as a result of those words.
Yeah, I remember when I met you, you told me the same thing.
I was raised on, like, you know, because I was born in England, right? So my dad being a rock and roll guy, you know, still to this day, he's telling me about new records he's found.
Wow.
So I was raised on, like, the Beatles and the Stones and the Kinks and the Yardbirds and all these other, even Gene Vincent, for that matter.
Yeah.
You know, so the Beatles were a major part of my upbringing. So I was always, that was like the background music of my childhood.
In your recent book, you tell a great story about a slightly older teenage girl, a bicycle, and an Aerosmith album. Would you share that with us? Because that eureka moment.
It was a pretty much a turning point. Well, I mean, I used to race BMX and do be a freestyle guy and all that, and I hung out in West Hollywood, and I was going to school, and there was this girl in the school that was a little bit older. She was at another grade above me.
Ooh, and an older woman.
Yeah, I was really, really had the hots for this girl. Anyway, so I pursued her pretty much the whole semester. And then finally she invited me over to her place one weekend. I guess her mom was out of town or something. And so I went over there, and she had all the sort of teenage accoutrements. You know, we had the pot, and we had some wine, and we had some Southern Comfort. And
all
we
the
had
necessities.
Candles and all that. And, you know, like Led Zeppelin, Cream, I remember Pink Floyd, all these records. And in the midst of all, which we put on and sort of talked and made out and whatnot. And then she had this album that I'd heard once at a party, like maybe a month before that I just fell in love with. But it was at a party. I didn't have control over the stereo. And there was this Aerosmith record. So I saw it and I put it on.
Which one?
It was Aerosmith Rocks. It was definitely, I heard a song off of it last night. And, and it's still to this day, it has a certain thing to it that just speaks to whoever it is that's in me, you know, that just really nails it on the head. I guess it's just that sort of reckless, high energy, sort of pseudo drugged out, you know, devil may care kind of attitude that that record had. And just as a teenager especially, it was like it was very specific to my personality. Anyway, so I put that record on and then got lost in that record. I must have listened to it, I don't know, over and over again, I don't know how many times, until finally, you know, because I completely ignored her. Finally, she just told me, I think it's time you should go home now. And I didn't care, you know, I didn't even think about it. I listened to that record backwards and forwards so many times, and then jumped on my bike and took off like I'd just gotten laid. It was the same kind of energy that I had going on. And that sort of really sort of got me set in the direction that I ended up going in.
What was the point? Who influenced you when you went from the how many notes can I play per bar to just the right notes in the right way?
I came from sort of the, you know, Hendrix, Clapton, Jeff Beck, Jimmy Page, sort of, those were like the four guitar players that I was, and Pete Townsend. Right, who wasn't a solo guy at all, and, no. And Mick Taylor and Keith Richards. I mean, all those, that whole bunch of guys. The thing that I appreciated about those guitarists was the notes that they picked and where the melody went. It wasn't so much how many notes there were. It was always about accentuating the actual vibe of the song. And the guitar break was, you know, there's the song itself and maybe the hook of the song and the vocal and, you know, the chorus or whatever. And then the solo break was the most exciting next step, right?
Right.
And it was an extension of the song. So it had to have some sort of melody to it or something that made the song sort of peak, you know? So that's what I was raised on. And then, you know, it wasn't, when I picked up the guitar and it was 1980 is when all the sort of Speed Demon guitar players started coming out.
Sure.
And the funny thing about that is they were all influenced by Eddie Van Halen. Everybody was trying to be Eddie Van Halen, who is probably one of the tastiest lead guitar players around, except for he sort of involved a lot of real, very original techniques that became a lot of his signature, but people always tapped into that.
Focused,
but they didn't. They never got like all the really tasty blues licks that he had going on. Anyway, so I sort of just stuck with that. I never tried to be Eddie because Eddie was already Eddie.
You know? Good decision.
And so now when I do, you know, whenever I get into a solo thing, it's always the most spontaneous thing that happens as a result of the vibe of the song. You know, and even when I go back to record the song after we've rehearsed it or demoed it or whatever, I always find that the idea for the first lick that I did that was carrying me, or, you know, that the song sort of took me to this place, and the first thing that I went for was the most expressive, and I always sort of stuck with that, you know.
Good instincts.
So it's not usually about a lot of notes. A lot of notes come with a certain kind of frenetic energy. You know, especially obviously with fast material, you know. Sometimes there's places where it just makes the most, it just feels right to go, you know, usually sometimes faster than I'm capable of even playing. But that's where it comes from. I'm not a technical guy, so I don't really sit around and do exercises to try and pick up on, you know, how I can be blindingly fast on guitar, because it sort of gets away from the spirit of what the song's about, which is why I don't do any big instrumental guitar records either. You know, I really like sort of guitar in the context of a framework of a song. You know?
I think you were in my broadcast booth at Texas Stadium, September 1988, when we both, you and I both, first met Iggy Pop.
Oh, well, when Guns N' Roses played Texas Stadium with the Replacements, NXS, and Iggy, and Ziggy Marley. Yeah, that's a very memorable.
Why?
Well, because at that point, I think, you know, Guns N' Roses, 1989, and Guns had just finished a tour with Aerosmith, and right. We were set to go to Japan and Australia, and then that 2.5-year tour was going to be over. Two and a half years straight, without ever going home, really. But what happened was, so we finished the Aerosmith tour, and we were high on that, but we were exhausted, you know. And so we had this one sort of weird build, gig in a stadium environment, which I think was the first time we'd ever played in that kind of a building. We played the Monsters of Rock, which was a big 80,000 person thing, and we played Giant Stadium. So we had done, but anyway, so we got there, and I just remember everybody was completely shagged, you know, and we were, I guess, in your booth. Yeah. It was our dressing room or whatever. We're all laying around, but we were very cocky, thinking, oh, it's just one gig, we got this licked, you know. So there was no sound check, was no real efforts made to. And we just thought we'd come out there and do what we've been doing. And it was just a disaster. It was a gig that the scenario, I have nightmares about. Where you just completely...
I never knew that.
Oh, yeah. It's the kind of thing where the whole band falls apart.
Oh.
Right? And I remember it was like sort of drizzling. And sort of drizzling.
You were playing in a Texas Stadium with its famous... No
right.
roof
yeah.
during a hurricane, dude.
Okay.
It was a hurricane that had come inland.
Well, at the time, it didn't seem like a hurricane. It just seemed like rain, you know. But anyway,
a lot of rain.
But it was just one of those gigs where just nothing worked. And we ended up, we came on late and we left stage early. And all things considered, I mean, I didn't. You know, worry about it too much at the time. It was off to Japan and whatnot. But the funny thing about that particular show was a few months later, I got sent an envelope from my management office, you know, because that's where I sent all my mail went.
Okay.
And it was from some fan who was seeing us for the first time in Texas Stadium. And he sent back the Appetite for Destruction record broken in half. Anyway, I always thought, you know, especially that, you know, however many months later, I always thought that was very entertaining, that cassette broken in half from that basic, you know, that gig.
But apparently, though, you haven't forgotten.
Oh, well, no, it stuck with me because that was a one-of-a-kind situation, you know. But anyhow, that wasn't the first time I met Iggy, actually.
Really?
I'd met him when I was a kid.
Tell me that story.
I can't really remember much of it. I was probably about 8 years old.
Oh, my goodness.
And
in England?
No, in Los Angeles.
Really?
And he was in a clinic, and David Bowie and my mom went to go see him, and I ended up having to go. There was no nanny or something. And so...
But you had to tag along. Yeah. There's no babysitter.
And that was the first time I ever met Iggy Pop. No, but it was very short, and I didn't know who he was at the time, and so on and so forth.
Well, let's say then, because I remember, the first time you meeting him
as
an adult or a professional musician, you and I both were in awe of the guy, and neither one of us wanted to approach him first, so I had to get up the nerve to introduce myself and then introduce you. And all these years later, from that day, I just thought it was so cool that you ended with Iggy working with you on We're All Gonna Die.
Yeah, he's one of the, you know, like one of the heroes of rock and roll that's still, you know, probably one of the most prominent ones, still doing it.
He's the last man standing.
Yeah, still has the same attitude, still has the same passion for it, but his personality is just unchanged, and he's like, you know, the real deal. And so I've always had tremendous respect for him. And, you know, and Duff was, it was and is a big fan of his from the moment that he and I met. I remember Iggy Pop was in our first conversation. Yeah. So Duff and I actually played on the Brick by Brick record and got to work with him in that capacity.
That's okay.
And so
this thing chugs just like the songs did on Brick by Brick.
We have a good, actually there was a song that we worked on together, which I haven't been able to release, which is really cool. It was called Burnout, and it's Iggy Pop and myself, and I can't remember who actually is playing all the instruments, but Lenny Kravitz is on it as well. And it was a really cool song, and I actually took the music and used it for a song with my band, the second incarnation of Snake Pit, because I didn't think I could ever release the Iggy Pop version. And so he gave me permission to use the same material and use different lyrics, and had a song called Ain't Life Grand. But now, having done that, I can't rewrite it with Iggy Pop. Anyhow, but it was good to call him up and get him to sing on this particular song. And there was one of the cool things about this song with Iggy is when I sent him the demo, he called me up a week later and just sort of gives you an idea of how Iggy still is to this day. He calls me up and he goes, "Hey Slash, check this out," right? And he puts the phone down on the table and walks across the room and turns on a stereo, and my demo starts blasting out of it from across the room, right? And so it's blasting, and he sings it from in front of the stereo.
No way,
right? So it's all sort of in this sort of it's a quasi mix. You know, and I'm sitting there, and he starts singing the song. So he goes from one end to the other. So I'm sitting there for 3+ minutes, and then the song ends, and he turns the stereo off, and he walks. You can hear him walking across the room, and he picks up the phone. And he goes, "Hey, what you think?" And that was how that song was basically together. Yeah, I don't know. With Appetite, it's always even before it was ever, big record. It always was a great representation of those five guys that made up that band and the sort of the whole story that goes along, you know, the band getting together and how we lived and how the songs were written and all that kind of stuff. And so I just always thought that it was a really good representation of the band, and was always really fond of everything having to do with it. And so, you know, years later, and the album gets really huge and all that kind of stuff, I always look at it fondly because it was the record that everybody had in their record collection. When I was a kid coming up, like, you could always judge people you were hanging out with by what records they had.
Right.
And so, you know, certain records definitely meant that this person was, like, really cool, you know.
Good taste.
And an Aerosmith record and a Zeppelin record, but then there would be some other interesting records that they might have that would really give you an idea as to the depth of the person you were with. Yeah. And funnily enough, the Appetite record has turned into one of those universal albums that everybody has. And that, to me, is the coolest thing. You can't really try to live up necessarily to that kind of an expectation. You sort of just have to leave that one as an isolated incident, you know? Being that I'm not actually in that band anymore, I don't feel the pressure of having to do that album, because that was those five guys, and it was the only five guys that could have made that record, and so that was the only real album we ever made as that lineup. So you can't go and try to recreate that on your own, you know.
No, of course.
It's got too much of a chemistry thing to it.
And the
innocence of it, the whole sort of young, angry. I mean, those songs actually, in a lot most cases, actually wrote themselves. I mean, they just came. There's not one conventional arrangement on that record.
Wow.
And it was just made up by guys that didn't have necessarily had talent, but didn't have a hell of a lot of experience, and just wrote the way that we felt like writing. And and we were we stuck to our guns, and we knew that we were the best at what we did, and we didn't take any shit from anybody. How that record somehow became a hit record was a crazy kind of a fluke, really, because as cool as the record was, I don't think anybody had, I wouldn't even have discovered as being what it ended up being You know, like I would never have thought, oh, it's maybe as big as Ace of Spades, Motorhead, or something like that.
Yeah.
But that Sweet Child of Mine crossed over, and all of a sudden people looked at the whole rest of the record in a different light. And that's a one-in-a-lifetime kind of occurrence, you know, when something like that happens.
It's amazing that you, of all the songs on it.
I never had an understanding of, you know what it was? It was at the time, when, you know, Guns was a pretty hardcore, raunchy, hard rock, you know, in-your-face yeah. kind of a band.
Yeah.
And when we did any kind of a ballads, it was any kind of a ballad, it was usually like a slow blues thing that fit right into sort of our groove. But Sweet Child of Mine was an up-tempo ballad, which always sort of used to, I mean, I love the riff, and I love the vocal, and I love the chorus and the solo section, everything. But as a whole, it always stuck out in the set to me. So I had a sort of a struggle with that song.
Really?
And it was ironic that it turned out to be, you know, this huge hit that it ended up, you know.
When you and I would have been together there in 95 on the radio in Dallas, you had just become officially a U.S. citizen.
Yeah.
Now, I got to ask you, because you're in a, and it has nothing to do with rock and roll, it has nothing to do with your talent, but as a human being, I'm really curious to know how you feel about all of this hot button issue that immigration has become recently politicized in America, and particularly here in the Southwest,
right, right.
The states of California, Arizona, New Mexico, Texas, that all border Mexico. What's your perspective of being somebody who technically didn't become a U.S. citizen yeah. until long after we knew?
I finally had some serious immigration issues, and that's what forced me to have to go and pursue the American citizenship, because I had a visa that expired, and I didn't know it, and showed up at LAX, and they were like, uh-oh.
Couldn't travel.
And I almost got deported and
whoa,
all that kind
seriously?
Of stuff. Yeah,
seriously?
Yeah. So that's when, you know, I started looking at it. I mean, I never really paid that much attention.
Of course not.
I knew there were rules and so on and so forth. At this point, you know, I think it's all in the wake of 9/11. And so there's a lot of... Everybody's alerted to the safety, you know, the border safety situation. And when you talk about the Southwest, because that's happening, that's pretty big happening right now. You know, I don't know if I agree with what a tight band they're putting on that and some of the stipulations that are coming across. And I don't like to get into what you call politics. And,
well, see, I don't think it...
But that is something I don't agree with.
A political thing, but I think it's become politicized. Yeah. And I think that maybe myself, I think it's kind of a straw man. I think that there's other underlying things there, because mm-hmm. immigration is what's made this company
makes this country awesome, yeah.
And you're a perfect example of that. If you were born overseas.
You know, I definitely believe that there should be certain regulations to it, but I don't think it should be as policed as it is to the extent that it is now. But, you know, on the flip side, I do understand that they're watching everybody that comes into the country at this point, because there's a certain element of paranoia going on. And for good cause, because we've had some serious issues with all, you know, our terrorist stuff and whatnot all across the board. So I think it's a matter of looking at it less from such paranoid eyes and more as looking at it realistically, you know, it's all a risk in some way, shape, or form, no matter how you look
life.
At it.
When you got up this morning, when
exactly,
I got up this morning, it's a risk, right? How did you feel when you heard that after, what, 15 years of eligibility, Alice Cooper finally being inducted into Rock and Roll?
I think it's sort of silly that it's taken this long. But anyway, yeah, I wrote him a note, and I actually...
Do you mind sharing what you said?
Oh, I can't remember. I wrote a thing about Alice for, I think it was a publication that was asking me about my opinion on Alice Cooper coming into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And, you know, I mean, he was the guy from, you know, when I was a kid coming up, Alice was the guy that represented a production that was...
Awesome.
Far and above, more elaborate and interesting than anything anybody else had ever done, and he did it with a certain amount of gusto. Plus, there was some great and songs and everything that, songs. You know, and I always actually, I think it was Alice Cooper that made me sort of, in those days, dislike Kiss because I always thought that...
he had set the bar.
Yeah, I thought was that was... Yeah, I actually can appreciate old Kiss now a lot better than I did. But back then, I had a problem with them because I thought Alice was the real deal and there was a certain amount of intellectual content in I thought he was a great lyricist. So
he's a very bright guy.
Yeah. So anyway, you know, and I've been friends with Alice for a long time, and I think that a lot of artists wouldn't have a lot of the things that they've got going on over the years if it weren't for Alice Cooper breaking that mold,
including
Guns N' Roses. Yeah. And I remember when we opened for Alice in 1988. And, you know, actually watching firsthand how that all works and how he does it. And then he's such a cool guy, you know. He's one of the coolest rock, personalities that I've ever met. Anyway, so I'm glad that he's making it into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I still think it's a little late.
It is. Yeah. But better late than
later. Than later.
Same subject. Yeah. Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And you know you're going to get it.
No, I don't.
Oh, yeah, you're gonna get it. Okay, if the question isn't if, it's when. What will that kind of recognition?
You know what? I've been asked this many times in some way, shape, or in some way, shape, or form, and you know what? We'll cross that bridge. If we get inducted, we'll cross that bridge when we get to it. Because I couldn't. I'd be lying if I had any prediction whatsoever of how that's gonna roll.
Would something like that, an induction into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, whenever it comes, when you're eligible next year even, would that present an opportunity to use the word exorcise at the beginning of our chat here today? The ghosts that hide?
Who knows? Okay. You know, I figure if anything like that happens, it'll be the thing we least suspect that does it.
I believe you. I believe you when you say that. I believe you're not being invasive. I know you got to go, and we really appreciate you.
Oh no, it's
here.
It's great to see you.
It's great to see you, and it's great to catch up with you. Did it occur to you when you guested for, I think, about a week on American Idol recently, did it occur to you that if it had not been for your collaboration, the thing that you pointed out at the outset, at the top end of this conversation, if it hadn't been for your collaboration, your ability to work patiently and easily to serve the song with all of these myriads of bands, great bands, and as a featured sideman with some of the greatest people and singers in the world, if it hadn't been for that, if you were trying to break into the business now or in the last decade, there wouldn't be a place for Slash in an American Idol world that we find ourselves in.
No, I don't think so. I mean, that's a good question, or actually a good statement. It's not really a question. It's something I never really stopped to think about because I'm so wrapped up in whatever it is that I'm doing that I don't really stop and look at really what else is going on or.
Well, American Idol's been going on pretty big and has had. I'd say that and iTunes have been the two biggest things to happen to the music business in the last 10 years.
Yeah.
And with the focus on the singer as being the whole package, no collaboration whatsoever, no acknowledgement of where the song comes from or where the players come from or who arranges, it's just all about the
vocals,
one.
Yeah.
Well, have broken in?
In that reality, and you're talking about sort of a pop world, which has always been, it is a big commercial, corporate kind of reality that has always, in some way, shape, or form, been there.
You're right.
You know, from my optimistic viewpoint, I always try and look at the half full kind of thing, side of things, but, so it's just an overly developed version of something that's always been there. But that said, you know, when it comes to rock and roll and rock bands and the doors that we used to be able to sort of knock down to be able to succeed in that realm is severely limited now, you know.
Do you feel at all like an endangered species?
No, I don't feel like an endangered species, but I definitely feel grateful that I've managed to hold on this long, because it's sort of a wasteland out there, you know. There's not a lot to grab onto. And I, you know, you see, I just did a bunch of festivals in Europe, you know, and rock festivals, and the spirit's definitely alive and well, you know, as far as there's people out there doing it, and the energy's great.
Yeah,
and
when you put the tickets fans on are sale, great, they yeah. Show up.
But there's something about the record side of it where they just, it's hard to get records made, and it's hard to get signed. It's hard, and that's where I fit in. If I was to be coming around, starting my career as we speak, you know, I'd be looking to join a band and then looking to get that band out in front of people. And the chances of getting a record deal or being able to succeed professionally in the record business are a lot more limited than they were when I first started. You know, so, yeah, I don't know if I would have the same opportunities coming up now that I did when I was, you know, 19 years old.